Hey guys, this is Mike Mahaffey, the old bastard BJJ guy, here for BJJ Metal Models. Back in my day, we had to walk uphill in the snow both ways to get to the academy just to learn some crappy technique from a random purple belt. You kids have it so easy, because now you can just subscribe to BJJ Metal Models Premium and get tons of great audio courses to learn new techniques, enhance your mindset, and entertain yourself. You can even get personalized rolling reviews from some of your favorite BJJ Metal Models coaches, including me. It's like having your own seminar, you spoiled little whippersnappers. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to BJJ Metal Models Premium right now, get off my lawn, and go train.
Hey, welcome to BJJ Mental Models, episode 260. I'm Steve Kwan. BJJ Mental Models is your guide to a conceptual and intelligent jiu-jitsu approach. And today, all of our listeners know that I love when I'm visited by a fellow podcaster. And that's what we got here today. We got Mr. Scott Sivright. How's it going, Scott?
It's going well. Thank you, Steve. How are you?
I am doing well also. Let's plug your stuff, man. You know, we've dropped the teaser there. Everyone knows you're a podcaster, and I'm pretty sure most people will recognize your podcast. But why don't you talk a bit about yourself, the work that you do, and where people can listen to you talk?
Okay, well, I'll try and keep that brief. I started a coaching podcast about just over 3 years ago now, the Primal MMA Coaching Podcast. For better or worse, we have been exploring an ecological approach to learning, not just grappling, but mixed martial arts and striking too. And it tends to jump around between more recently coaches, but initially it was more academics and stuff in the sports and skill acquisition space.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Your podcast, I mean, if someone is a coach that really wants to dig into the reeds, your podcast is one of my favorite ones to do that, simply because you do get so technical and you go so deep into this stuff. And it's cool that someone is exploring that. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk a little bit about with you today here. Now, you mentioned eco. I think a lot of people are probably going to be familiar with the general idea. We've had some guests on who have talked about it recently. But maybe from your standpoint here, if you were going to kind of explain eco to someone, and I asked this selfishly because I was just asked to do this the other day and I don't know if I did a good job, but if someone asked you and said, hey, look, I've never heard of eco, what is it? For someone who has no background in that, how do you explain to them what it is and why it's important and even worth learning in the first place?
Well, first of all, it's a challenge. And when I start trying to explain it, there is a lot of buzzwords, a lot of jargon and terminology that people aren't used to, and that can come over as pretentious or, you know, unnecessarily wordy and just kind of put people off. So I'm trying to change how I talk about it, because I don't think we've done a great job. Some of the, you know, advocates out there for eco, I don't think we've done a great job of, you know, bridging that gap and getting the message out to people who have, you know, no concept or never heard of it before. But I had to put it in a nutshell. I would say that it's about how we learn to navigate and act in the world. It's about building relationships with the world and the environment uniquely to yourself. Doesn't necessarily just pertain to jiu-jitsu. It could be all kinds of sport, just life in general. The ecological approach just makes an assumption that we act within the world and we perceive that, see, I'm already coming away with these buzzwords, but we act within the world and perceive it directly. And we kind of learn by doing, and learning is an active process. Learning is not a passive process. So we take part in learning, and that's one of the things that we advocate for. And I think this is why there tends to be a bit of tension between maybe the more traditional approaches to learning, where it's kind of broken down and isolated and put back together. We just kind of flat out reject that from an ecological perspective. So I think there's a lot more carries over or a lot more overlap between the, if I can call them, two camps. But I think one thing I'd like to just, you know, reiterate again is that from an ecological perspective, we have to kind of be active explorers and active learners within our environment. So a lot of the stuff that maybe the old traditional teaching models have promoted, we kind of flat out reject that. And I think that's where a lot of the attention comes from.
Yeah. You know, honestly, you and I were talking about this. I think at the end of the day, if you unpack what people are really doing on the floor and what their intentions really are, if you put aside people's preconceived notions about which camp they're in, often what I find is that the amount of commonality around what instructors agree upon these days is pretty great. And we'll get into this in a bit. I mean, part of what I wanted to talk with you about here is how can we make ecological dynamics actionable for students? Most of the conversation has been directed at coaches. And a question I get all the time from our listeners is, hey, this stuff sounds really cool, but I'm a two-stripe white belt and I have no control over the class structure. So what can I do as the person in the class to train more ecologically? But maybe before we get into that, I want you to kind of just check something that I said. So I was on a Josh McKinney's podcast, I Suck at Jiu-Jitsu, the other day, and he asked me to explain eco, which is hilarious because I am not a coach. I'm not a scientist. The one thing I guess I have in my favor is that I'm an imbecile. So that allows me to speak to other imbeciles. But the way that I describe...
Well, you're in good company then.
The way that I described it. Okay. Think about the Matrix, right? Think about the scene where Neo wants to learn Kung Fu. So Morpheus and crew, they plug a needle into the back of his head. They upload Kung Fu into his brain and poof, just he learns Kung Fu. Eco basically just tells us that that's impossible. That's not how our bodies learn to move. And I don't think there's a single person out there that would disagree with that. I can give you all of the information about how to do an armbar, for example. I can sit you down and make you watch hours of armbar instructionals, and you can understand it conceptually just absolutely perfectly. But until you've actually tried to do an armbar, it ain't gonna work. Because it's one thing to understand conceptually what the idea is. It's another thing for your body to be programmed how to move. And there's a variety of reasons why eco tells us that we learn the way that we do. And that's kind of what the ecological approach in my mind is useful for, which is it informs us about how human bodies learn better. And the main takeaway is like people have to figure it out on their own. Yes, we can talk to people, we can tell them techniques, but at the end of the day, I can never simply download a technique out of my brain and upload it into yours like the Matrix. All I can do is give you some guidance to kind of help you figure it out on your own, because we all have different bodies. The situation's always variable. Anyway, that's the answer that I gave. How badly did I mislead people? Is that like an okay layman's definition?
Well, I'm at a disadvantage because I've actually never seen The Matrix. But no, I think you did a pretty good job there. One thing I'll put in it, it might sound as I'm come across as a purist, but I don't think ecological approach is telling us how we might learn better. I think it's trying to explain how we learn. But as far as your kind of summary, your synopsis went there, I agree. I think you did pretty good.
Awesome. Well, this to me, like you said, as I think we're a big part of the disagreement is people often look at eco as a method, but it's not a method. Eco is a series of scientific findings. It is something that you can use to inform your method and to build your own method on top of. But there's no point in the ecological framework where it tells you, okay, this is how you teach someone to do an armbar. It just gives you some insights into how, to the best of our knowledge, human beings develop movement-based skills. And so I think this is, again, where people might have a bit of a misconception about it. They think that eco is like the Atkins diet, where it's telling you exactly what you need to do, and you're either eco or you're not. But it's not, right? Eco is more like gravity. It's a concept. It's a way to explain the world. It applies whether you're informed about it or not. It applies whether you believe in it or not. But it's in your best advantage in a lot of situations to understand how it works. And that's kind of how I look at eco. The eco doesn't tell you, and this is where I think some of the friction comes from. You'll hear a lot of eco people talk about fully abandoning all techniques. I mean, you don't necessarily have to do that if I understand correctly. I mean, you can kind of dabble into it and move progressively into that level. I think the main thing is that I want to clarify is that eco doesn't prescribe to you what you need to do. It's just science. It just explains how we think things work.
I think you're right there. And I think this is a common thread that I'm seeing, you know, when people are going back and forth that, oh, that practice is so IP or this practice is so ecological. Now, I think there's certain practice activities that lend better to either maybe an information processing approach or ecological approach, but it doesn't tell you really anything about the activity itself. It's just a lens to look through. Now, you can teach it like a technique, and that's worth maybe just addressing too, the difference between maybe a technique and a skillful action. But I think you're correct there. It's just a framework, and you can absolutely teach a technique ecologically. I think what we're speaking about in a dynamic sport like martial arts is that we don't put a great deal of, say, emphasis or importance on an idealized technique. We know there's some things work better than others, and that kind of informs how we design our practice. But to your point, there's no such thing as an ecological practice or an IP practice. It's just frameworks and lenses that you can look at practice activities through, and it helps guide the practice design.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Now, in terms of how this is going to help a white belt or someone who maybe isn't even a white belt, but is just a white belt in eco, if they're hearing this and they're thinking, man, this sounds complicated, I don't get how it impacts my training. What I would say is, look, if you have been training for more than 5 years, there's a good chance that you probably came up in a school that uses the old method. And by the old method, I mean, you show up to class, there's a bunch of random drills that have basically nothing to do with what you're going to do in class just to get you warmed up. And then the instructor shows three techniques and you drill them against an unresisting opponent. And then you do live sparring, which is just complete open season. Anything can happen. I've always kind of referred to that as the old classic three-part way that a lot of gyms teach. And the main issue is that's based more on tradition and intuition than it is on something that actually works. Because if you've spent a lot of time in that kind of class, as I have, you'll observe a few things. First of all, you'll observe that the warm-up drills are basically useless. Even if you try to make them relevant, they probably, in most gyms, are not going to be things that directly actually help your jiu-jitsu in a meaningful way. Then you get into the instructor shows a technique and you copy it part. And the issue there, and this is a pain point that almost every grappler in the world feels, is, yeah, I can do an armbar if my opponent is just sitting there doing nothing. But the instant they put up even the most tiny bit of resistance, everything falls apart. Part of that is just because in a real fight, there's just so much variability. And that's kind of where eco really shines, is it gives people a practice method and a tool for figuring out how to deal with variability and get experience with variability. And then the last part of the traditional class is just open sparring. And you, honestly, I mean, that's probably the part of class that most people enjoy the most because it's fun. But open sparring is not always a good way to build skill because, I mean, you will get better, but it's not really consciously led or consciously designed. The problem with open sparring is if I put you into a match with someone and your objective is to win, you're going to resort to your A game, to the stuff that you're already most comfortable with. You're unlikely to try new things or to explore out of your comfort zone. And that kind of variability really helps with training. So that's why in most gyms, they will employ some degree of constraints. And at the absolute simplest, they'll say, okay, you know, we're going to restrict the field here. So your goal is we're just doing guard passing or something like that. And that's what we call positional sparring. And that is a constraint, but you can go far, far beyond the thought that you put into constraints to help with skill development. Because just by doing a positional sparring situation, you're still going to have people who kind of funnel into what they're comfortable with. So a big part of eco is you create these open field scenarios where there's kind of an invisible hand that's trying to steer students towards the thing you want them to learn so they don't just turn every sparring session into a death match. When people started first talking to me about eco, that's kind of what I realized the value was, look, this existing old school three-part class structure, it just wasn't working for me personally. And that to me is the appeal of eco. But again, I mean, I'd love to hear your perspective as someone who speaks quite well about this topic, if you've got any thoughts to add on to that.
Yeah, I put a pin in quite a few things you said there. I think you're really doing the approach justice here, the way you're talking about it. And I think we can like make a caricature out of the traditional model, right? As you said, we come in, we're going to shrimp down in lines and forward roll and then sit around and listen to 100 details of three different moves and try that and blah, blah, blah. I'm not sure that's quite as prevalent as it used to be. However, I'm still somewhat surprised. And without naming names here, I had someone come in for a free trial the other day, visited another gym, and they were only allowed to participate in the warm-up. So he said he did some, I think he was calling them inchworms, which I presume were shrimps. And then they said, okay, that's it. It's too dangerous to go ahead of this. So I think that caricaturized model that we're talking about still exists to a certain extent in a lot of gyms. And the problem with it is not, I don't think that it's just not necessarily the most effective way to learn. I think it could be quite boring. And from a getting people engaged in the sport kind of thing, I think we're doing them a disservice. I'm kind of crass the way I talk about things sometimes, but it seems like we treat new students as if they're stroke victims and we're having to learn how to move all over again. And I just don't think that's the case. So what the ecological approach is doing is it's just taking the role of a coach rather than being a, you know, just to deliver knowledge of techniques into a passive group is, like you said, identifying where challenges are for different learners, whether they be brand new first day people on trials or whether they've been at it for 6 or 7 months and so on and so forth, and just dialing in that appropriate challenge point. Because that's something that's spoken a lot about in the ecological approach and overlaps in all kind of learning environments, is that challenge point, that pushing people to the end of their comfort zone and, you know, giving them engaging problems to solve is where the learning really seems to happen. So it's certainly not a hands-off approach for coaches, but it's a very, very different role. And it's a tough role for coaches because, one, they have to take a leap of faith and say, I'm not really sure if how effective this is, because we have to measure learning over the space of weeks and months, not over a session. And it takes away the status of a coach in a sense that, hey, look, I have all this knowledge. I've been doing it for a long time. And look, I can tell you, you know, I can talk chapter and verse about every single position and scenario and technique. And you kind of rob the coach from that. So a coach that wants to go into the ecological space, they're kind of giving up that. In many ways, they're having to relearn how to coach again. Should they be trying to come to the problem through an ecological lens or approach?
Now, let me ask you a question here. How much of the resistance to this and the kind of the issues surrounding this do you think is cultural? And I ask this because, and when I say cultural, I'm not talking about like a country. I'm talking about the culture of jiu-jitsu as a whole. The reason I ask is because, you know, when I got into jiu-jitsu, the marketing at the time was like, this is the technique that was used by cage fighters to win in the UFC. And very much the philosophy of how to onboard a new student was throw them into the shark pit, let them get tapped out by a bunch of blue belts. They're going to see that this works. They're going to be so impressed. They're going to sign up their first month of jiu-jitsu, right? That was the idea. Now, to some extent that works, but I would say that there's a few problems with that approach. First of all, it sets the culture that this is a fight club, not a learning lab. And, you know, when people talk about how it's too dangerous for white belts to spar, I always think that's very much on the feet of the instructor and it's part of their problem. I mean, you can't just say it's because a bunch of white belts who are completely peaceful in life just randomly decided to kill each other on the mats. A big part of it is because you sold this to them as a fight club. You told them the goal of every session was submit or get submitted. That's very different from telling them that we're doing skill development games. And to me, that is one of the most appealing things about Eco. It makes jiu-jitsu playful. You're not in there necessarily to tap some person. You're in there because there is a skill that you want to learn, and your quote-unquote opponent is an active participant in your skill development. They're your friend. They're not your victim. So I always wonder how much of this resistance is cultural and is just because people think of jiu-jitsu as a fight club, whereas maybe they should be thinking of it more as a learning lab.
Yeah, I think you're right, but I think everyone's kind of comes down to the culture. And I think we'll get onto that there, how we bring people into our environment, into our learning culture, so to speak, and how you build that culture up. For us, my partner Ben and I, we are on the mats for all the trialists, the foundations from day one. So to broadly answer your question, it's all cultural. I'm not talking about from different countries or whatnot either. It's the culture that you build, and everyone comes in with different traits, different capabilities, different action capacities, different psychological traits. You know, to your point, some people would thrive in a fight club. They would thrive, and you could beat them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they'll come back the next week, and other people be, you know, immediately put off. So I don't think there's a perfect answer for that either. And that's, again, puts the onus on the coach to read the room, get to know the students, and try, and it's not easy, Steve, but to try and find appropriate level of challenge for each individual, which across a group is a real challenge. But I think it can be done better and worse, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's funny. A while ago, I was talking to Doug Lamov. I'm sure you know who Doug is.
Yeah.
He's an author.
I've read his book.
Yeah, he's amazing, an amazing resource if you want to kind of learn how to bring teaching best practices into the sports and the coaching world. But I remember I was having a chat with him, and at some point it clued into him that, look, unlike soccer or something like that, where, you know, you can be relatively sure that the same group of people are going to show up every day and they're at the same skill level and you know who's going to be there. I explained to him that, like, look, in jiu-jitsu, as an instructor, you're going to have a room full of 20, 30 people. You have no idea who's going to show up to your class before they do, right? In most gyms. I mean, it's not like it's the same team every time. People show up whenever they want. They're of all skill levels, all different goals. You can't guarantee that the lesson that you taught yesterday is going to be known by your students today because they might not have attended yesterday. And I remember that kind of blew Doug's mind that there was like that much variability in a martial arts class, because that throws a lot of traditional coaching practices out the window if there's that much variability in terms of who you're trying to coach. And I think this is a very underappreciated aspect of the jiu-jitsu and MMA coach's role, which is you basically have to coach every person individually. You can't assume that everyone is at the same level, they're on the same team, they've attended the same classes. You have to really pay attention to each person specifically if you want to help them grow. And that, I think, is an underappreciated piece of the coach's game.
I think the coach's game generally is underappreciated because I'm a safe distance from, you know, there's lots of hats that we wear. I'm a safe distance from each individual bullseye. when we're talking about the ecological approach, it tends to be more centered around a skill development perspective. But there's, you know, there's man management, there's sometimes you're a counselor, you're a psychologist, you're a motivator, you know, there's all sorts of things going on. So actually, I love coaching. I love trying to be the best coach I can because it's enormously rewarding, but it's an enormously challenging endeavor too, right? Now, one thing I think is quite liberating about coming at it from an ecological approach is that we're looking for, and I think we should, I'll explain a little bit what I mean by the word, but we're exploring, we're trying to develop relationships. And I don't mean personal relationships, of course, you know, interpersonal relationships and group dynamics. We're always trying to, you know, build a good culture there. But I'm talking from a movement and skill acquisition perspective. We're looking to build relationships. Are they just moving their bodies and acting and perceiving and in a way that's a little bit better each time? Or do you see these relationships building? And I think when we come from a perhaps a more traditional perspective of looking for some kind of idealized technique, I think that can be a challenge because there's a lot of frustration there, right? There's a lot of frustration from the coach, or they're not quite getting this, or they didn't do that correctly, or that's not what I told them, or they missed that detail. And then that's a lot of frustration for the student themselves. But when you look at it through that ecological lens, that you're not really caring about these outcomes, what you're looking for is these relationships to start to become established and developed. And you, this lens that you're looking through, you're not quite looking for technical ideals, that rather you're looking for these relationships to emerge and build. And I think that's enormously liberating for a coach. And if you just start to reward and give great feedback, you know, I celebrate all the little wins, even the smallest little wins for students that are coming in. Maybe they almost got swept and they managed to base out. And these are the kind of things I'll celebrate across the room at every level. And so for me, it's been a very, very liberating way to coach because I don't feel I ever have to really critique. The only times I'll step in and I have what I don't have tolerance for is recklessness or putting your training partner in harm's way. Everything else is just a big old experiment, and I kind of just only celebrate the little wins.
Nice. I love that approach too. And I agree that it makes the room a lot more fun. If you measure success in the gym exclusively by results, like who's winning the roles, who's winning the tournaments, there's a variety of problems that can occur. One is it could destroy the collaborative nature of the gym if you look at everyone there as your enemy that you have to defeat. Additionally, like I mentioned earlier, it can steer you away from developing new skills because if you think you're in a fight, you're always going to use your sharpest weapons. I'm not going to start working on random techniques if, from an identity standpoint, it's important to me that I win this role rather than learn. And it's just more fun, right? I mean, if as a coach, your focus is student retention for most people, and again, your mileage may vary. Like you said, there's a lot of highly competitive people out there that thrive in a pressure cooker environment. But I'd say for most people, you want to have fun and you want to enjoy the people around you. You don't want to hate or dislike or be afraid of the people around you. And every gym that I've ever seen that really succeeded over the long term, whether it be a hobbyist gym or whether it be a highly competitive gym, it was the fact that it was fun that kept people engaged and kept people there. And if you don't like your training partners, if you don't have that cultural connection, it's very, very hard to retain students because they're not having fun, right? And what is the point of anything if you're not having fun?
We'll keep going back to that word culture, yeah? I couldn't agree more. So there's certain things I really believe in, you know, and what we're doing here and how I have a coach. And there's some things, you know, I'm kind of on the fence. I could be persuaded otherwise. We don't have a curriculum. We're primarily no-gi, so we don't rank. We have a foundations program that is lively and fun enough that higher level students come in. So I talk about them as being my room full of ambassadors, right? So because we've decentralized the coaching and there's no kind of one authority, there's always this kind of support system built into the foundations class. You know, that whole kind of cliche that the two spazzy white belts going together. We don't get too much of that here because we tend to partner people up and they gravitate towards, you know, people, they start to bond and we change everyone's partners up in that. And what's been really, I think, valuable for us is having a very, very diverse group and each person really supporting the next wave that are coming through. And one of the constant bits of feedback I keep reminding everyone, we all had our first day once, no one cares what you look like. Clumsiness is a feature of the learning system. It's not a bug. Frustration is a feature of learning. It's not a bug. And again, this is just building the culture from the ground floor. Everyone feels safe to come in and make mistakes. Again, it's another cliche, but and Doug Limoff talks a lot about it. It's a lot of Dweck's work, creating that kind of psychological trust within the group that you're safe to make mistakes. And that's something that I think has helped our people thrive. Psychological safety, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah. I think that's highly important for a variety of reasons that actually go beyond skill development. Psychological safety is also very important for conflict resolution in the gym, right? I mean, how many examples have we heard of something terrible happening in a gym and it just got hushed up and no one wanted to talk about it? I mean, psychological safety is the control mechanism that's going to help you as the coach manage the culture and know if something is happening. And also, it's going to be the thing that allows people to kind of go out of their comfort zone and look vulnerable. For people who don't know, psychological safety is a management practice. Basically, the idea is you want to encourage your people to be vulnerable and speak their minds. You never want a situation where people are afraid to look weak, because that's just going to result in people closing off. And in the context of skill development, that means they're not going to try new things because they don't want to look bad in front of their instructor. So again, very much a cultural thing that you can model here. Now, here's a question I have for you, right? I mean, I would hope that by this point, you know, we've kind of explained what ECO really is about and what its benefits are. And there's going to be a lot of people out there listening to this who say, man, this sounds amazing. I wish my gym was like that. My instructor is doing things the old way and I'm not learning and I'm frustrated and I want to try this. But the problem is I'm a one stripe white belt. I have no say in how the class is run. And this I'd love to get your feedback on, because almost all of the conversations I've heard about ECO are from the coach's perspective about how you can, you know, from the top down, reorganize your gym so that it's got a culture of ECO. But in this particular case, for a lot of students out there who are interested in this, they don't have the ability to restructure their learning that way. They've got to work within the framework that's already there. Short of telling people to switch their gyms, I usually don't like giving that advice because it's often not a feasible option, right? There's a lot of factors that lead to people picking a gym beyond just whether they're ecological or not. If you're at a gym and you want to try this stuff, but you don't have that kind of control over your class and your training, what can the average student do to make their training just a bit more ecological?
And I'm not allowed to say change your gym, right?
Well, I mean, at some point, that's always an option. There's a lot of reasons why people would want to change their gym, but sometimes it's just not feasible. I mean, if you live in a remote or rural area, sometimes there's only one gym there. Your choice is either train there or don't train at all.
I get the question. So the question would come, where can you identify the opportunities to scratch your own itch? I love that little phrase, you know, because we give a ton of time for people to scratch their own itches. Steve, I'm sure you've got parts of the game that you've been drawn to for whatever reason. There's things I like to do within the sport, and you can call it your A game or whatever. And so that's a balance, right? You don't want to get stuck in it to be too one-dimensional in sport and whatnot. But if they can just start to, one thing you've probably heard us talk a lot about from the Eco guys is guiding your, coming in with some kind of intention and guiding your attention to where these kind of key features of the exchange or the dynamics might be. And if they can just maybe start, once it comes around to the open rules, is maybe just take a step back from maybe necessarily winning the role, so to speak, but maybe creating themselves some little micro goals within that role. And that's not easy, right? That's not easy. You've asked me a tough question because I don't have a good answer for it. How could they maybe scratch their own itch ecologically? I think that would be my answer. You know, when you do get the opportunity to have the kind of the constraints removed and get a bit of free rolling, or maybe even through a situational drill or a spar or whatever, is try and identify problems. I talk to my team about this all the time. Identifying problems is a real superpower because the solution's generally not that far behind. And the more you get better, Kit Dale was talking about this the other day, the more you get better identifying problems and finding solutions, it becomes so much more easier. And then you can really take any position and any problem, and the solution's just not that far behind. So in a long-winded way, if just say you've only got 15 minutes at the end of class to have an open role, then that would be the time to constrain yourself. And what I mean by constraint would just have more of a narrow objective that you're looking for within the role, not necessarily. And it could be anything. That's the best answer I have for that question.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think to your point, you know, constraints are a big part of this answer. If you're training at an ecologically informed gym, your coach will have probably put a lot of thought into the constraints at play here. But if that's not happening, if you can find a willing partner, and that's always the catch, if you can find a willing partner and agree with them to kind of change the rules of the role, you can create an ecological approach within a little microcosm within that role. Now, that does require communication with your training partner and an agreement to do this. If I'm sitting down to roll with you and I say, hey, Scott, you know, I discovered this eco thing. I want to try some guard passing games here to just kind of manipulate, you know, just to get my grips better. But I'm going to need you to play along with this. And if you come back and say, no way, man, I'm here to train UFC and fight. I want, you know, winner take all. Well, then we can't really do it. At the bare minimum, you often kind of need to have a willing partner. I would say it gets easier when you're more experienced, because as a black belt, I can choose to just handicap myself. I can just do eco if I want to, because I still have enough of a skill base that I can defend myself against my training partners. So I do this a lot. I will go in and I'll say, you know, I have observed that I have a tendency to hesitate when I go in for like a leg entanglement and I'm getting my guard passed because I'm not moving quick enough. So I can kind of develop a little mini game and make a commitment to myself that, hey, today in class, here's the specific thing I'm going to try to steer myself into that situation to work on my comfort zone. And, you know, my confidence is high enough and my jiu-jitsu is good enough that if it doesn't work, I can still survive and I can probably force the roll back to that position so I can get more reps. But it's harder if you're a white belt, right? Because everything is new. You don't know what's going on. You don't have the context to make these kinds of decisions. The only thing you can really do, I think, is get a willing partner who's willing to help you out.
Right. And again, that comes back to the cultural aspect. I'm going to have a little stabby here. You said you hesitated a little bit. I don't know if that's actually a problem you have. I would suggest you're maybe getting stuck in your head and overthinking it a little bit. But anyway, to bring you back to the cultural part, again, my gym is not for everyone and it's not how everyone should run their gym, but culture is really important to us in having this kind of supportive framework where everyone's kind of exploring that ability to, and we give our people a lot of that autonomy, right? Within either MMA, striking, grappling, I'll have them design their own games for a portion of the class because that gets them kind of thinking more kind of from a constraint. Led approach, what we're trying to do. It gets them to identify problems that perhaps they're enthusiastic about, and it gets them to get behind this build game design, you know, endeavor. And there's a lot of good research as well that supports that fact that if you can give your students and your learners the sense of autonomy, I mean, this comes down to, I forget exactly the exact experiment, but I think they had some kind of golf putting experiment, and merely by having the participants choose the color of the ball, the performance went up. So I think giving your people autonomy for at least a section of their class to, again, scratch their own itch, design their own games is enormously powerful. And then why would a coach worry? I mean, I don't worry about bad habits. I worry about people getting hurt. That's all I worry about. But this isn't hyperbole to say this. I think sparring eventually fixes everything. And so I don't really worry about people giving, yeah, a white belt giving someone another white belt advice, because I don't care about that, because it's either going to work. The advice that white belt is given either works or it doesn't. And we're going to find out when we put it in a live scenario. So this, I think, is probably in many gym cultures, the sage on the stage, the oracle of all things is the coach, and no one else is remotely qualified to give their tuppence worth. I think that's extraordinarily detrimental to the growth of the group itself.
Now, you mentioned something there that I think is a hot button topic, which is the fear of bad habits. I have heard this from a lot of instructors where they are, more than anything else, they seem terrified of instilling bad habits in their students. And I kind of understand that, because all of us who have been training for a while have a personal memory of a bad habit we developed that we really had trouble shaking, and how much better we felt once we finally shook that habit. I've heard many instructors who I respect greatly basically say their problem with loosening up the training environments and giving people more autonomy over their training is they're terrified of the development of bad habits. I get that. However, I would argue that, look, if you want to evolve your skill set in anything, there are going to be bad habits that get developed and have to be discarded along the way. Progress is not always a straight line. Progress is a bumpy, rocky road full of long terms and obstacles. And the thing about progress is what really matters is your ability to course correct and persevere. So I worry sometimes that instructors overly control their class because they're so terrified of someone developing a bad habit that they just want to have the reins completely. But I mean, I'm reminded of some conversations I had with Robert Deagle, who's talked about how, look, philosophically, with a lot of complex ideas, you have to make mistakes along the way, because those bad habits and those mistakes, they're part of the evolutionary process that got you to the next level. And then eventually, at some point, you can discard or grow beyond them. But if your expectation is that you will grow your students without them ever making mistakes, you're going to kind of paralyze yourself and never be able to help your students grow. And I think that's one way that kind of overly controlling teaching models handicap themselves. Because if you're so concerned about people making mistakes that the instructor has to control every single variable, you're kind of introducing yourself as a bottleneck to people's learning now, because everything has to funnel through you. And the benefit to any self-organizing system like Eco or even Reverse Classroom or any of this stuff is by giving people control, eventually you grow other leaders within your group who can do the job for you, and it just helps move the entire culture up a level rather than making the instructor the weak link in the chain.
Well, I agree, and it's something I'd like to unpack a bit more, because I'd like to know exactly, you know, maybe give me an example of what a bad habit is, but failure is the self-correction model. So, you know, we can talk in from, you know, more a dynamic system perspective where you can, you know, create these strong attractors in sense of, you can maybe call that like a bad habit, that's something that you're routinely doing. There's a tendency for them to less likely to develop if there's this constant self-correcting, the failure in itself and the valid feedback that you're getting, the immediate feedback, or did it not work? Did it work? Did it kind of work? Did it fail miserably? This is what helps develop skill in and of itself, is self-correcting. So again, I don't really know. I think it's a mute point. I don't even know what a bad habit is necessarily, and why would I worry about them? They're part of the learning pie.
Yeah. Well, the example that I can give that comes up very often is beginners are often told, like, let's say that you're mounted on top of me. Beginners are often told things like, never extend your arms. You got to keep your arms in tight and cover your neck. When you're someone's mounted on top of you, that's kind of the standard defense that many white belts at many gyms are taught. What I've sometimes called the home alone defense, right? Where you put your hands up onto your cheeks like Macaulay Culkin. And now the thing is, in a lot of ways, that particular defense is not really optimal, especially at a high level. There are better things to do if you want to defend yourself and escape the position from mount than just sit there at the bottom with your cheeks covered. That said, many gyms will employ that method as a defense for very early on white belts, almost like training wheels, because out of the gate, your goal here is not necessarily to show people how to defend perfectly and have black belt level defense from the bottom. The goal is just to prevent people from getting armbarred or choked in stupid ways and to give them some level one defense. But what almost any grappler is going to develop over time as they get better is they're going to realize that's really not a good defense across the board. You're better off trying to destabilize the person on top, use things like hip movement to try to get your guard back. There's a lot of other things that you can do that are more productive than just sitting there with your cheeks covered. That said, I also understand that if you are a day one white belt, giving them something that they can latch onto, even if it's not technically entirely correct, can be helpful with the idea that they will outgrow it. So that's what I mean when I talk about instructors being kind of worried about bad habits. They're sort of worried that they're going to teach something that's less than perfect, and that their students are going to be misled for years and years and years. But I agree with you completely. The whole point of a good training session and a good training environment is to create a learning feedback loop. I mean, if you're doing something that is no longer optimal at the level that you're at, you're going to find out real quick.
You're going to find out real quick, yeah.
Yeah, when I started rolling with black belts and I tried the home alone defense, it didn't work. I just, you know, all they would do is choke me through my own fingers. So I learned real quick that doesn't work. It wasn't a huge deal that I'd made a mistake along the way, because I have the tools to fix those mistakes. So that was kind of my thought on the process.
No, I agree. So here's another bad habit, and we've all known, when you have someone's back, you cross your ankles, right? And there's something akin to that, you know, when someone's in striking, they're throwing maybe the lead hand and they're dropping their rear hand. You can tell them, you could talk to them ad nauseum about it, not crossing their feet. They're going to continually do that until they're going to get ankle locked a few times. And then that little learning moment is going to correct that bad habit over time. So again, I don't think that bad habits should be avoided. I think they're actually a very valuable part of the learning process. So to try and create or cultivate a learning environment that doesn't have any bad habits, or to try and sterilize your learning environment from bad habits, isn't only an impossible endeavor. It's kind of defeating the point, kind of robbing the learning environment from these necessary errors that are going to facilitate learning. And from the ecological approach, the coach does most of the work in setting up the practice and then, you know, adjusting it on the fly, just, you know, with the levers and buttons and knobs and trying to get the challenge point right during the practice. But for the most part, it's the environment that's doing the teaching.
Yeah. And this is one of my favorite objections to eco, honestly, is where people say, well, you know, if my coach is doing a fully self-organizing structure, that means they're not doing any work. You know, why do I need a coach if they're not telling me what to do? Why am I paying you however much money every month if you're not actually doing your job? And I mean, to that, I'm sure I don't need to convince you, but what I will tell anyone is, regardless of whether we're talking about martial arts or the workplace or some other organization, self-organization is almost always going to be more work for the people on top than just telling them what to do, right? Like, it is not easy to build a good self-organizing culture. Because like you said, you as the instructor now, you have to be acutely aware of everything that's going on in your room, and you have to create those silent goalposts that steer people back into the right direction. That is a lot harder than just telling people what to do, right? If you want the easy thing, just grab three techniques off of YouTube and show them in class and tell people to do them. That's the easier approach. But the problem is, like we talked about earlier on this episode, any student who's been in that system a good period of time will have probably eventually gotten frustrated because they hit a plateau, right? Self-organization is not easy. And I think it is just an absolute myth when people think that it is easier somehow than a more old school approach. Running a self-organizing environment, whether you are a manager at a company, because this is actually a major area of business process development in the last 60 years or so, right? Making your teams more self-organizing, it is a boatload of work to do. It's a lot easier just telling people, hey, do this right now or you're fired. However, self-organization often outperforms those kind of more classic command and control methods over time, right? So that's the reason we do it, is because, yes, it's more work, but it yields broader results.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think self-organization is just a fundamental part of the universe. So I don't think we switch it on or switch it off, but I think we can rely on it a bit more. But yeah, to your point, this is, or to the larger point of the whole conversation, this is very, very difficult for a coach that's maybe been doing this a long time. I'm not suggesting stuck in their ways, but there's you know, I'm stuck in my ways in many ways that I coach. But to completely abandon or go 180 from the approach you've had can be a real difficult for the ego. It could be a real scary place to start for coaches. And this is often why we maybe tend to, when we were originally approaching this problem or trying to, you know, spread the word of ecology and grow our cult, so to speak, we'd start on the warm-ups, you know, and because this was a low-hanging fruit, maybe just add a little bit more liveliness, a little bit more decision-making, a little bit more unpredictability to your warm-ups would be a good way to go. And from there, maybe coaches could start to appreciate how engaging it is, how effective it is, and build from there. But to your point, I have a lot of sympathy for coaches because I used to be one, right? That was a sign of my coaching effectiveness. Look how many details I can give you here. I fucking wonderful. And I've so long since abandoned that. But it takes time. It really takes a lot of time. And it's a great leap of faith, right? It's a huge leap of faith to not be explicitly teaching people for two reasons. Because one, that's what they expect to come in and be taught. And two, it takes a long time. How do we measure learning? I mean, how do we measure learning, Steve?
Man.
And what are your metrics for the culture? As you said, you're not coaching much at the moment, though. But what would be your metrics for an engaging, vibrant growth culture?
God, that is an almost unanswerable question. I don't know how I could. I mean, to some extent, if you want to talk about culture, you can maybe, you know, you can get people's feedback. You can look at retention rates. There's things you can do. But to measure learning is, I don't even know where to start.
And that's a clue, right? We're not quite sure what it is. For me, again, and this is my own interpretation, I'll start to see relationships emerge and look, are you routinely being more effective and successful at particular elements of the game? And we have all these, and we have to have them anyway, but we have these arbitrary metrics for levels of skill in the sport, right? We have our stripes, we have our belts. But in many ways, you know, I'm black belt level at some things, I'm novice other things, I'm purple in other, if we're to take that. So the messiness and the non-linearity of this approach is daunting, but it's reassuring in some ways, because you just don't need to have to be that certain, because you know you can't be that certain. We can design a game and think, I think we've kind of got the principles and the features down that should elicit some kind of learning response, and we just have to try and trust it. But we don't really know, and people can say they've learned, but we don't really know until that starts to routinely show up in the game.
Man, when I was a white or a blue belt, I had some instructor come in and do a class for us. And he was, at the time, I remember, he bragged that he knew like a dozen ways to strangle a man with his own collar. And I remember the whole room was like, oh, wow, professor, you're so wise and powerful. In retrospect, knowing what I know now, that guy was like the worst instructor I've ever had in my life. He was absolute dog shit terrible. But yeah, that is what happens when you think that your skill is based on the number of techniques that you know. Look, I don't know a lot about jiu-jitsu, honestly. Like you said, and I think you brought up something wise, your belt ranking is not like a uniform indicator of skill. You can be a black belt at some things and be a white belt at others. And it took me a long time to get comfortable with that, with the idea that like, look, this journey is not about collecting as much knowledge that I can regurgitate, like I'm doing a test or something. This is about my ability to perform. It's about my ability to go outside of my comfort zone. And at some point, it becomes about my ability to convey that knowledge to other people. And that is much more valuable than just memorizing techniques. So I think that you are completely spot on that just having a technique count is not a valid indicator of skill. And this is something I experience. You know, you want to talk about differences between info processing and eco, right? I mean, that's really getting into the reads here. But like, I can tell you, an odd thing about my life now is that as this podcast has grown and the premium services behind it have grown, you know, a lot of my work now is administration. You know, when we get hundreds of people who want to have their rolling footage reviewed, so we've like built a whole platform to route that, and we try to connect coaches with people that they can help out. We try to promote things that we believe are important to the community. Because I spend so much of my time in conversations like this with you, I find myself in this weird situation now where there's a lot of things I know, but I can't do, because they're completely different. Like, I can sit down and talk to, you know, Preet Mikkelsen about his defensive framework for 10 hours, which I've done. But at this point, am I good at playing his style of game? Not really, because I haven't actually put as much mat time in on that. And I haven't set up constraint-based training environments to work those positions.
You're also not Preet.
Yeah, well, exactly.
You have a complete different, you know, set of traits and cultural, socio-cultural bag, everything. You're just not Preet. So, yeah, you know, I can rarely get through a podcast without maybe throwing some shade on seminars and stuff. And again, I'll say I never get invited to do seminars, but there's this tendency to, as long as there's this industry of showing instructionals, of having the secrets that's going to change everyone's game, it's creating this learned helplessness within the community at a whole. What we're trying to do, and it's quite a lucrative as a business, because we're saying, hey, figure it out. We're going to give you some principles. We're going to give you some guidelines. We're going to give you some support. But ultimately, your learning journey largely relies on yourself, not driving and paying $200 for some seminar, not getting every single instructional with all the different detail minutia downloaded into your brain to go back to our initial conversation. It's very much, you're going to have to put in the work. You're going to have to learn by doing. There really isn't no shortcut. And we're not saying the ecological approach is a shortcut. What we're saying is we think, we understand that we can get more out of an hour of grappling or MMA or whatever endeavor we're doing by staying true to the principles of ecological learning.
I love that point that you brought up. I would argue that most seminars and most instructionals are just simply not worth the time and money. There are some that are very good, but ultimately at the end of the day, I don't think it's necessarily the most effective or efficient way to learn things, especially due to the sheer volume. I mean, so many people go to seminars, pay hundreds of dollars. They never use any of the techniques they picked up there. So many people buy instructionals, spend hundreds of dollars, watch it once, never take the time to actually apply it.
It's like the self-help books. Who buys self-help books? People who've bought self-help books. This is like the thirst for self-help. It's like the same as instructional. How many instructionals do you need? I mean, look at anyone, most, even the top grapplers in the world, their games, they've got two or three things that they do great. They can do everything well, but they've got two or three things that look great. And to tell ourselves we're going to be this, have this enormous repertoire of skills and techniques, I just think it's missing the larger picture of, one, how do we develop in the sport, and how do we just enjoy it? Because it's a hobby for most people, right?
Yeah. Well, that's a very important thing. It's something that I know my brother has brought up, which is if you're in a regular jiu-jitsu gym, probably the majority of people who are there, and ultimately the people who are paying your bills, are hobbyists. So if your expectation is that these people are going to spend 3 hours a day studying instructionals on their own time before they come to class, like you may not be selling to the right audience. I mean, it's different if you're running a highly competitive team and everyone there is a full-timer. But if you're talking about, you know, mums and dads who are doing this, you know, two times a week as a hobby, and your expectation is that they're going to be on top of the meta, and your expectation is that they're going to be watching and paying for all of these instructionals, you're deluding yourself and you're setting an unfair expectation for them. I mean, this is the reason why we do things the way that we do here. I mean, people always, you know, they ask me, like, why doesn't BJJ Mental Models really do anything visual? Why don't we release an instructional that is like you get anywhere else? And my answer is, I just don't think they're going to help people. You know, if people want a visual instructional, there's already some great ones out there. But moreover, I just don't think for the average practitioner, that's going to be the thing that helps. What I hope I can do is give people a bit of strategic thinking or philosophical thinking that primes them to go and try something else in the gym. Or maybe I can connect them with coaches that explain things in a way that resonates with people. But I would never be so crazy as to think that through a podcast, I can teach you how to do an armbar. Similarly, I think it's also somewhat crazy to think that through a video instructional, I can teach you how to do an armbar. I can give you ideas, but like you know, if we're talking about eco, as soon as the shit hits the fan and this turns into a live role, it doesn't matter how closely you study that armbar on the video, right? It's a totally different ball game when some guy is sitting in your guard trying to smash pass you. Nothing is going to work the way that it did on tape. So, I mean, our approach is very much informed by trying to give people like little carrots that they can use to kind of follow and set up a journey, little incentives. And then on our premium stuff, we do actual detailed rolling reviews where we break down people's actual sparring footage. I always believe that, look, if you're going to watch video instructional, watching instructional some other dude doing techniques is never going to be as valuable as watching video of yourself doing it, failing it, and having someone tell you what you maybe should try differently next time. I always think that that's a better approach. And I do agree with you that the current state of the universe when it comes to instructionals is not really eco-driven. And I think that's why so many people struggle to retain information from those instructionals.
Yeah, and you know, I shit on instructionals for the most part, but I think they have value. I mean, that value has to come in. You can take perhaps one detail or maybe a handful of details and come in and try it. There is no shortcut. And again, I think it just perpetuates this codependency of a coach and a student for the student to be spoon-fed the answers from the coach. I think that's unhealthy in the long run. I think it's ineffective in the long run, and it's not going to push the sport forward. To put it in a nutshell, I'm trying to make my students here as independent as possible. And to your point about, you know, some are just hobbyists and want to come for a social outlet. It's their friends are here. That's all great. Don't think being a hobbyist and trying to be a world champion at the same gym or environment, I don't think they necessarily be mutually exclusive environments. I think everyone wants to be better. And if you can get better at any kind of rate, I think that is what the culture should be looking for. So you should have a culture that if people want to get the absolute manifest, the best versions of themselves they can be on the mat, you have that for them. And if people just want to come in and train and have fun and really not care too much about, you know, performance and competitive chops and whatever, you can have that too. And I think in a well-structured, and I'm hesitant to use the word structure here, in a well-planned ecological environment with different levels of challenge throughout the gym, you can create a culture that's vibrant for everyone.
I think where eco is actually especially useful is when you've got a highly diverse environment. When you've got a lot of black belts sparring with white belts, that's where I think eco really shines, because you can have asymmetric constraints. I can put one set of constraints on the black belt to effectively handicap them to make the role more fair. Good example of this, Rob Bernacki has a whole system that he uses to do this where people can kind of self-employ constraints on themselves. He calls it fuck your jiu-jitsu because of course he does. But anyway, the idea is basically that you kind of self-employ constraints on yourself so that every role is a challenge. And the idea being like, look, if I'm sparring with a white belt and I am a black belt, if it's a level playing field and we're just doing jiu-jitsu, it's not really a fair fight. But if I constrain what I'm doing, like I wade into the white belt's strongest position and I force them to put me on the defense, I can still get value out of this role. And that's where I think that eco really does shine, in that it gives you flexibility that lets you tailor every training session to be optimal for you.
Yeah, you're right. Most people have done that intuitively anyway, forever. Before Johnny come lately, eco boys were on the scene. Everyone's been kind of constraining themselves and meeting their partners where that's been a good training partner. That's all that's been. That is irrespective of what theoretical framework you are, be a good training partner.
Let me dig into that, because that I think is one of the main criticisms that I hear of eco. I don't know if it's really a criticism, but maybe some pushback is when people have eco explained to them that you're using games to kind of steer teaching towards the area where people can develop the skill themselves. The counter argument that many people will give is, well, but that's not new. Just like you said, I mean, you can look back decades and you can see Kit Dale, Ryan Hall, Rob Bernacki, all of these people using these techniques. It's not new. The only thing that's new here now is we're tying it to the scientific framework And so, I mean, what do we say to those people, right? If people are already doing some degree of gamification and they're already benefiting from this, is that truly eco, or is there anything that they need to be doing to kind of turn the dial up? Or, and I mean, it's a fair question, is there any point to doing that? Is gamification enough, even if you don't understand the ecological science behind it?
Well, again, back to my original, I think it's all eco and all coaching is constraint-led. So there's always, any time a coach steps on the mat, regardless of what they're doing, having someone technically shrimp up and down is still a constraint of sort. All coaches use constraints. All coaches believe fundamentally in self-organization, even if they can't articulate it. All coaches believe in the challenge point. They're trying to necessarily create a learning task or activity that is suitable for the learner. So these are the things that we all kind of agree on. I think what's getting lost here is when some in the more traditionalists say, well, we do that anyway. And we're saying, great, yes, we do that anyway. But what we're saying is let's just only do that. Let's look at a practice. You spoke about the traditional practice, and let's try and use critical thinking. Let's try and use the research that's out there, and let's try and parse out what is actually facilitating learning. This is what I think is giving the ecologists a bit of an advantage at the moment. It's not because reinvented the wheel. It's because they've said, hey, we're going to take a 60-minute or 45-minute or an hour and a half practice, whatever it is, and we're going to reject and throw out some of the stuff that we don't think is very effective, and we're just going to fill it with more of the effective stuff. So there's always been an overlap. I totally agree. And maybe push that point home. Do you think, it's a rhetorical question, do you think you could get good at jiu-jitsu by only static drilling? I don't think anyone's advocating for that, but we're just saying it's unnecessary. If you can identify there's better ways or worse ways, or there's more effective practice activities and there's less effective practice activities, I think what the ecological approach and lens is giving you is to say, okay, let's take all the really effective stuff, boil that down so it's retain its effectivity, but keep it at an appropriate challenging level from someone who's coming on day one to visit your gym all the way up to preparing for ADCC trials or whatever. And let's just have more of that.
Now, this is where I think people have a hard time wrapping their head around what ECO is proposing. A lot of people are under the assumption or the understanding that if someone is doing true, pure ECO, they're not teaching techniques at all. So I know, for example, I've heard people say that, you know, Chris Paynes doesn't teach techniques. His students just evolve them organically. Greg Sauter is the same thing.
I'll jump on that wagon too. I don't teach techniques.
Okay, but so here's the thing, right? To a lot of people, that sounds preposterous. And much of this, I think, is probably because people grew up in a certain system and it's hard to look outside of the, you know, the neighborhood you grew up in. But I think the other thing too is I think people have a fundamental misunderstanding of what's being said. Can you maybe walk me through this? Like, if we're saying you don't teach techniques, what does that actually mean? Like, what does a class look like? Because surely at some point, there has to be a level of common understanding. I'm positive that if I walked into your gym and I said, show me an omoplata, right? I'm positive that all of your reasonably advanced students could do that. And that means that at some point, the technique existed and was communicated to them because we have a shared language. But so at some point, the technique does exist within the gym. So how do you balance that between this idea of, but we don't teach them? That's, I think, the thing that many people get hung up on because it's so counterintuitive compared to the old training methods.
I think you have a good and valid point there, right? And you're right. It seems preposterous that you would come to a gym and the coach isn't shown a technique. And again, I do mean it. I don't teach techniques. Now, teaching a technique is just such a heavily constrained action. It's still really part of the constraint-led approach in many ways, because if you're teaching a technique, you're constraining it. It's almost impossible to fuck up, right? But to your point about, especially now, right? And this reverse classroom model that keeps popping up. In many ways, we're all running a reverse classroom model, right? As soon as we open our phones, there's instructionals where lots of us like to watch grappling and stuff. So from an ecological perspective where the mind is bodied and embedded in our environment, they're inseparable. Always seeing things happening. We're not saying mimicking and copying what other people do isn't a part of the ecological approach. Not at all. So I think over time, these things do appear. I'm not trying to skirt away from your answer here, but often we might start people close to a finishing position of a said technique on that, but we won't be explicitly teaching the steps of a technique. An arm and choke, maybe different configurations where we can give them names. Omoplata, that's a little bit different, but we can design games that will tease that out organically. So am I kind of squirming out of things by saying we don't teach techniques? Perhaps, because maybe we're leading people almost to that technical space, if that makes any sense. To say we sit and call techniques necessarily by their name and go and practice that sequence with the different steps. We don't do that. And I think to the point is everything's emerged organically over time. And what the coach can then do is expedite that discovery by nudging people and nudging their attention to certain areas. Let me ask you this, Steve. Do you think we've discovered every technique that there will ever be in jiu-jitsu yet?
I don't even think we've discovered every technique that we're going to discover this month, man. I mean, the evolution of the sport is crazy fast.
I got white belts or buggy choking purple belts and brown belts here. I mean, I just said we didn't do the ranking, but like other people come in. So again, we're all kind of running this reverse classroom model. This isn't the old days where you had to go and get a picture book out of the library to study techniques. They're just rammed in our faces every time we open our phone now. So I think that's whether it's either subconscious or we're kind of picking up on this. Oh, that looked cool. I tell people that all the time. I don't care if you saw it in a fucking Batman movie last week. Come in and give it a try. Because you never know if you're going to scratch down in something, what you're going to unearth. There's some treasure down there somewhere. Go and try it. And I think when we're in this space where people have interest in jiu-jitsu, they're watching it, they maybe have instructionals, they maybe saw something on an Instagram reel. In many ways, that's, again, it's the kind of environment that's leading them to that point of discovery.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I think the thing that I would want to double click on there that you said is that the thing about eco, again, it's not a method. It's not like the Atkins diet where you're either doing the eco method or you're not. It's a scientific framework. And the idea is it attempts to explain how the human brain and body work together to teach us new movement skills. You can't choose, I mean, if we presume that eco is true, you can't choose to not be eco, right? Because this is just how your body works. That would be like saying, I choose not to obey the rules of gravity. You don't have to believe in it. It's going to impact you one way or the other. So from a coaching standpoint, understanding eco at least can give you a leg up because it can help you organize your class more effectively because you will have a better understanding of what we believe to be the best way that human beings learn movement. You can strip away some of those things that maybe aren't optimal for learning skills and focus on things that maybe are. And you bring up a great point, you know, on the topic of do techniques exist or not? You know, people always freak out about this because they think it's so absurd that an instructor could teach without teaching techniques. And I think sometimes they think that means that the techniques don't exist. Like I saw people on Reddit joking around about how like Greg Sauders must blindfold his students so that they can't see arm bars and stuff because it'll, you know, mess up their concept-based training. That's not what happens. Like these techniques still do exist. But I think where that, you know, the actual nuts and bolts technique-based stuff is helpful is for conveying understanding. It gives us a shared vocabulary. I can walk into any gym in the world and I can say, you know, show me a triangle choke. And everyone in the gym will understand what I'm talking about. But the beauty of the situation, and this is where eco comes in, is no two people will do it the same. It's no two people are going to show me the same triangle. They will all have a different way of doing it. So it's actually not the same technique.
That's the point we're making, Steve, and I think you articulated better than I. We're saying there's, okay, so what is the technique? If everyone's doing it slightly different, there's variation in every time it's done. There's different forms of resistance. So it starts to become slippery. What is actually a technique? I would say that I've been talking about this recently, that coaches teach for aesthetics and technique. But when it comes to game day, they really don't give a shit about that. They're caring whether you win and what's effective. I see this in striking all the time, right? And especially in the striking arts, you know. I don't care how beautiful your quote-unquote jab is. Are you routinely landing it in a fight and not getting scored on? So coaches on game day give two shits about technique. They're caring about effectivities. And what the ecologists are saying is we are designing games and practices that tease out and strengthen and develop effectivities, not techniques.
Yeah. I mean, if people want to know how in their minds they can rationalize these two things, that's the answer I like to give. Techniques are important for conveying understanding. Same with like mental models. When we talk about these mental models or concepts or principles, like, look, I cannot teach you how to do jiu-jitsu just by talking at you, right? I can't. At some point, you have to do it. If someone sits down and they marathon every episode of BJJ Mental Models, but they never actually train, they're not going to be able to do jiu-jitsu. Now, they might conceptually understand it, maybe even to the point where they can communicate it to someone else and they can speak the language. But that is a very different skill set to actually being able to do the job on the mat. I think where the friction often comes up is people often think that eco is an attack on the idea of having techniques. And I would say it's not really. We just have to understand that these are two different things. When we talk about techniques, these are labels and concepts that we use so that we can communicate with each other and convey understanding. But at the end of the day, I don't think anyone, no matter how old school they are, is going to argue, if you want to ultimately learn jiu-jitsu, you've got to do jiu-jitsu. You have to at some point do it. You cannot learn jiu-jitsu just by studying instructionals. So I think that these two things do live in harmony. I don't think they necessarily replace each other as much as people may think. That's the area of the eco argument that kind of always puzzles me the most, is that people kind of act like it's either techniques or it's eco, and these two things cannot exist simultaneously. I think they do. I think they just solve different problems.
You're right. So I think this is, as we're rounding off here, I think this is an important part. The reason we perhaps ecologists don't care about techniques as themselves is a technique is either a tool or a movement or a sequence that is independent of context. Can you pull off a technique in a live exchange? Absolutely. But then I would call that a skill. So we see movements as skills, performance skills that are actively engaged within the environment. A technique doesn't require that. A technique is just the movement in and of itself. And that's why it's kind of absurd. It doesn't make any sense coming from an ecological approach to even talk about techniques. We're going to talk about skills and effectivities. So I think, yeah, it can be a little bit provocative, right, to say we don't teach techniques. But I think there's a conflation between techniques and skills, and they're very, very different things. You can be enormously skillful, but have, say, not, what do you say, poor technique. I think technique would probably come a little bit on for the ride. But conversely, you could be beautifully technical and have, you know, almost zero ability to execute that skillfully. So ecological approach centers around skill development, and we don't put much thought into techniques in and of themselves at all, because these are just movements. These are movements that can be done in any kind of a sterile environment without temporal constraints, without the perturbations of a resistant opponent. So we really don't care about that. That's the reason it's not really an interesting conversation after a while, because it's skill that we're focusing on.
Awesome, man. Well, Scott, I think this was a fantastic conversation here. I hope it gave people kind of an idea of, if they are just dabbing their toes in this, what ecological dynamics actually means in the context of jiu-jitsu, and how even just beginner students can at least start thinking ecologically when they train. But beyond that, man, before we tie this up, were there any closing thoughts, things you wanted to touch on that we didn't cover here today?
Yeah, just one thing. I know we didn't get too deep into the science here. One, because I'm probably not the best spokesman for it, because I'll make a real horse's arse of trying to explain some of the concepts. But the ecological approach does make a bold claim, right? We perceive the world directly and perception is direct. This kind of goes against most other traditional models of learning and teaching and development, is that we think we perceive the world directly and all the information that our environment's given us is enough to act accordingly. We don't need to do this extra processing. And almost every other theoretical framework around perception, around learning, it has this kind of cognitive middleman that we take in all this information, we do some calculations and processing, and then boom, the brain instructs the body in how to move forward. And it's almost like this cognitive sandwich. So it is a bold claim from the ecologist. We don't have that cognitive sandwich. We are dealing with the world directly. And just to finish off there, I've still got a little niggling doubt in my head whether I can absolutely say for certain that we perceive the world directly. I believe it is very persuasive to me, but I don't know for sure. So there's that little caveat there, and I'll stay agnostic. But for the most part, I think it's a wonderful way to learn, and don't be too put off by the buzzwords and the terminology, because once you get used to using them, they're just words.
Absolutely. Well, I think we had a great chat here, Scott. I mean, if people want to dig deep into eco, there's really only a handful of places that are going to cover things in the kind of depth that you do. So why don't you go ahead and plug the podcast, how people can listen to your stuff, and how they can reach out or contact you if they want to chat with you, connect with you, get advice. How do they go about doing all of that?
Okay, well, you can always contact us. We're mostly active on Instagram under Primal MKE. We are an MMA gym, fully committed, for better or worse, to an ecological approach and environment. Thank you for allowing me to plug my own podcast, which is the Primal MMA Coaching Podcast. It's not nearly as established or as polished as yours, but I'm working on it. And if any coach reaches out to me at all, even if to tell me I'm full of shit, which I welcome all kinds of feedback and reach outs, and I'll endeavor to communicate and get back to anyone who gets in touch.
Yeah, if you are a coach that likes to really dig into the reads, I mean, the thing I love about your podcast is it targets a specific and important niche. I can't think of many other people who do. It is a very deep, science-based podcast where you talk to some of the other, really the key practitioners in the sport, right? A lot of the names that people will have been familiar with on our podcast, they've spent a lot more time talking to you in a lot more depth about these things. So if someone out there is a coach, they're interested in eco, whether they want to just understand it more or whether they want to kind of transform their gym's training methods and they want to go real deep, your resource, the Primal MMA podcast, is the number one I would recommend. I do have to ask, though, I've always wondered, where does the name come from? What's primal about it specifically? Like, what was the selection behind that particular choice of word?
Actually, I didn't love primal when my partner came up with it, but I run a gym with my partner, Ben Schultz, and he came up with it. I thought it was cheesy as fuck, but lo and behold, it's on my hat, it's on my clothes, it's on everywhere I can get it on now. I'm sticking my name on it, so it's just how it came around.
Dude, I can relate. I cringe a little bit every time. And whenever someone tells me they like BJJ mental models, I kind of think, fuck, if I, you know, I guess, you know, this is another good example of could you have grown to the point you're at if you hadn't, you know, done things a certain way many, many years ago. But I don't know if I'd go with the same name now that I did back then. But in any case, man, yeah, I love your work. Thank you so much for coming by here too. I think this is a fantastic chat. As I always do, I'll put a link to all of that stuff in the show notes. So if you didn't catch the URL or you want to know where to contact Scott or find the Primal MMA podcast, just pop open your podcast player, go to the info or the notes or description or whatever it's called. There'll be some links that you can just tap to hit that directly. I'll also put a link to our stuff. Everything we make lives at bjjmentalmodels.com. That includes the podcast, the newsletter. It includes our premium services. Or if you just want to contact me, there's a form there to do that. I definitely recommend if somehow you're listening to this and you haven't listened to the podcast before, you know, we've got well over 250 hours of free educational material there on the public feed. All of that stuff should be just as useful as the day it was recorded. So I do recommend checking that out. We also always recommend people sign up for the newsletter, also completely free. We're not going to sell your data. You can unsubscribe whenever you want. But the main thing that you'll get there is, in addition to show notes for every episode we do, you also get a kind of a detailed thought piece and a deeper dive every week, plus a lot of cool freebies and other things that we give out, like free instructional sometimes. Beyond all of that, if you want to go to the next level with us, the reason we're able to do this ad-free is because of BJJ Mental Models Premium. That's the main thing that pays the bills. It's a massively popular subscription service that's totally unlike any of the others you'll find out there. As I probably hinted here today, it's not a traditional online academy. There's a bunch of different things you get if you sign up for premium. First of all, you get our audio course library. There's no techniques really there. It focuses entirely on strategy, tactics, concepts, philosophy, really interesting, useful stuff featuring some of the best minds of the sport. We also have premium ongoing podcasts featuring one with Drew Foster, one with Emily Kwok and Joe Hannon, and we're always looking to expand that. And of course, like I mentioned earlier, you also get rolling reviews. I'm not big on traditional instructionals, but man, you can sign up for premium and for just a handful of bucks, you can have literally some of the best black belts in the world make a custom instructional for you. They'll take your rolling footage, they'll break it down, they'll tell you exactly what you need to do specifically. So if you want to have like a multi-time black belt world champ tell you what you're doing wrong and how to get better, that's the best place to do it. So again, all of that's at bjjmentalmodels.com. But Scott, man, I really enjoyed this conversation. I can't thank you enough for coming by and sharing some knowledge here. Eco is such a kind of a new, exciting area of the sport, but it can also be very confusing. I think you did a good job here explaining that for the layperson.
Well, and I want to thank you too, because it seems like there's a bit of tension growing between the so-called camps, and that seems to dissipate now, and maybe thanks to your memes and whatnot, but there's definitely a lot more in common. We're all trying to get better, right?
Eco memes will save the world, I'm telling you here. No, I mean, people wonder, like, for those who don't follow us on social, we basically went on a bender and just posted a bunch of memes about eco. I mean, the reason I did that, first of all, is because at least once a year, I like to pour myself a stiff drink and just fuck around on the internet and make memes. But also just, you know, I wanted to poke fun at just the ridiculousness of the situation. Seeing my friends and people I trust and respect fight over something so trivial is just, what can you do but really kind of poke fun at it? I think that kind of temperatures have cooled now. I think people have a clearer understanding of what eco is. And so I hope that, you know, we will kind of see these practices continue to evolve and get deployed more and more and more gyms.
Yep. Well, I hope so. As I say, if you're not in the cult yet, you will be soon.
Yeah. It's like a subcult, right? Jiu-jitsu is the main cult that we're all in. And then there's the subcult of ecological jiu-jitsu. It's just like nesting dolls, right? Cults all the way down.
Well, I keep saying until we're fucking each other's wives, it's not a real cult. So.
All right.
You can cut that part out. Okay.
I think I will leave it in. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Scott, man. I really appreciate it.
All right, bro. Thanks for all you do. All the best.
You too, man. And thanks to the listeners as well. We'll talk to you next time. Take care.